And welcome back to Subject to Discussion. I'm Sean O'Mac.
What were you that said welcome back?
Yeah.
Welcome to.
Welcome to. Welcome back. Another hour. It's a six-day commercial break from the show. And we'll be joined in a few minutes by Josh from Oxblog. He's a very prolific blogger out there. And three of them run it, Josh, David, and Patrick Belton from England.
He's a mega blogger.
So we'll be honored to have them on the show. And, of course, news all together here. And, of course, I want to open talking about the terrible tragedy over there in the South and East Asia, the tsunami, and some really grisly photos. Anybody happen to go on Yahoo, and they could bounce around and look at the pictures that the Washington Post put on. Just the devastation is incredible. And what I'm looking at right now is an aerial photo, courtesy of the Washington Post. Shows the tsunami-stricken areas near the capital coastal outskirts of Banda Aceh in the capital city of Indonesia's Aceh province. And it's just amazing. And according to the Red Cross, they're saying it could be up to 100,000 people could be dead due to the tsunami. And another picture I'm looking at is bodies strewn all over the beach. This is from December 28th. Researchers have retrieved 770 bodies along the Khao Lak beach just north of Thailand's popular resort island of Phuket, and that's terrible. And also from December 28th in the Vanakkani beach outskirts of Nakapattanam, I was trying to pronounce that, on a survivor search through photos of victims to try and identify their relatives, and a lot of grisly pictures of children and women. Most of the victims, they say probably a third of the victims are children and women, because the children, of course, didn't know how to, you know, at that age, don't know how to swim very well. And then the women, apparently, just, you know, who knows. And total estimated deaths right now, according to the Associated Press, is 76,000 right now. But like I said, the Red Cross is saying it could go up to 100,000. And yeah, just, it's amazing that the epicenter, of course, was close to Indonesia, and they're going to have 45. Right now, they have 45,268 deaths. Malaysia's got 65. Sri Lanka's at 22,500, and India was hit 6,900. All these are preliminary numbers, because who? No one really knows how many people were actually killed in this, and it's all just a guess. And it struck as far as Kenya. Kenya had approximately 3,200 miles west of the afflicted area, had one casualty. In Tanzania, 10. Somalia, 110. So just horrible, horrible. And a lot of people are asking me, how is a tsunami, making of tsunami? Number one, earthquakes cause the ocean floor to collapse in places and rise elsewhere, displacing water and generating waves. And the second stage is initial waves, largely underwater, travel very fast toward the shore. In the third phase is in the shallow waters near the shore. The waves decrease in speed while rising in height above the surface. In four, the tsunami reaches the shore, causing severe flooding and extreme currents. So that's well, that happens. A lot of that footage was pretty grisly. I was watching CNN. Actually, I got to tip my hat to CNN because they've been having the most thorough coverage of the disaster, because they have bureaus all over the world, and then CNN International. So it's been pretty incredible coverage they've been having. And like I said, right now it said the death toll soars to 77,000. And there is a blog people go to learn more about what's going on, and also to lend a hand and help. It's tsunamihelp.blogspot.com, tsunamihelp.blogspot.com. And
I want to let them people know that they can go into the lvrocks.com website if they listen. You know, the people that are listening. Go to the watch and chat, and you'll be able to see Sean.
Watch and chat, and you can see me. And
you can chat with the among the other people that
exactly
are also listening to the show.
Tsunami.
So it's pretty cool, yeah.
So yes. So
go to lvrocks.com and click on the watch and chat link.
Yes. Those who are coming to us from the Oxblog blog, Josh, we'll be calling him just a few minutes because he'll be with us a quarter after. About where are we at here with time? Let's see. About 7 minutes, we'll get him on the phone and have him talk about what's going on in the world. And it says hundreds of Americans are missing in Asia. Hundreds of Americans remain missing 2 days after a devastating tsunami struck Asia. But the statement says a large number have been located and are safe. Let me see. Bush administration officials sought to allay concerns about the missing, so it might be simply a lack of not being able to get in touch with U.S. authorities in Asia. And initially, the United States put up $20 million as a line of credit, and then that clown from the UN got in there and says it's not enough, and how we're, you know, cheap with the money. And then so then the Bush administration raised it to $35 million. And it's such a down payment, probably going to be in the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to aid. And let's see what else. It says there are tsunami areas may not need New World Bank IMF loans and International Monetary Fund. As the World Bank and International Monetary Fund assess economic costs to South Asian governments due to the cataclysmic tsunami, the current outpouring of aid could mean international leaders won't need to step in with new loans, economists say. So, and it just gets worse. The World Bank, which spends about $20 billion a year in development aid for the world's poor countries, says it was in talks with governments to redirect existing loans to reconstruction efforts. So, and what else? And I move a little over over to Israel a little bit. Ariel Sharon is moving up the Gaza withdrawal date. This is from Jerusalem. Ariel Sharon said Monday he'll seek final cabinet approval for a Gaza withdrawal in February, 4 months earlier than planned, and he threatened harsh retaliation if Palestinian militants try to disrupt the pullback. Under Sharon's plan, Israel will plow the entire Gaza Strip and four West Bank settlements next year, uprooting 8,800 settlers from their homes. Sharon says the continued occupation of Gaza, where 8,200 settlers live amid 1.3 million Palestinians, is untenable. Jewish settlements in Gaza come under attack daily. So, let's see what happens with that. And then Colin Powell talking about Iraq. The Iraq's elections will not end insurgency. Iraq's deadly insurgency will rage on no matter what the outcome of next month's election may be. That's from Secretary of State Colin Powell amid new questions about the polls at their boycott called by the main Sunni Muslim party. So, and he was on CBS News saying these insurgents are determined to have no representative government. They want to go back to a tyranny. And so the insurgency will continue, and the insurgency will have to be defeated by coalition forces. So, and CyberSource is what we're saying here. Rolando Jr. CyberSource, we spend so much money helping out other countries. I wonder how many would be first to jump and help us if we need it. Well, I do have to recall 9/11. I don't remember a single country lifting a finger to help us after 9/11. So there you go right there. And, of course, this is from Wednesday, courtesy of Carol Giacomo from the diplomatic correspondent from Reuters, saying that the United States failed to honestly assess Iraq threat. The United States is facing increasingly deadly attacks because, as in the Vietnam War, it failed to honestly assess facts on the ground, according to a new think tank report. And Anthony Korsman, a senior fellow of the Center for Strategic International Studies, said administration spokesman had appeared to live in a fantasy land when given accounts of events in Iraq. Let's see. Going around here. He said as of late July 2004, an administration spokesman still live in a fantasy land in terms of their public announcements. He put in a core insurgency force at 5,000 individuals, and experts in Iraq knew the correct number to be 12,000 to 16,000. So, And as of Tuesday, December 28th, at least 1,325 members of the U.S. military have died since the beginning of the Iraq War in March of 2003, according to the Associated Press count. At least 1,040 died as a result of hostile action, the Defense Department said, and the figure includes three military civilians. The next highest is British. The British military has reported 75 deaths in Iraq. And since May 1st, 2003, when President Bush declared that major combat operations have ended, 1,187 U.S. military members have died, according to the Associated Press count. And that includes at least 931 deaths resulting from hostile action. So, and now they want to raise that to 150,000 for the election, so we'll see what happens there. And let me see. And tough questions on prisoner abuse still to come. A new document showing widespread U.S. abuse of prisoners overseas did not provoke the intense backlash of Abu Ghraib photos, but could prove more damaging at confirmation hearings for President Bush's Attorney General nominee. He wrote some memos. Let me see. He'll be in spotlight because of his involvement as White House legal counsel in memos, which he laid out a new definition of torture that did not include some forms of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. He called some Geneva Convention's provisions quaint and said its protection did not apply to detainees in the war on terror. So, what else? Here's the number. Oh. The guest. There we go. And And President Bush signed a Sudan sanctions legislation. President Bush signed legislation in the law on Thursday that urges him to freeze the assets of Sudanese officials and government-run businesses to protest the violence in Darfur. And due to our insatiable ego, no one will ever help us. That's from Trench Work. Well, still, it'd be nice to see some of these countries have stepped up a little bit to help us after 9/11. I know Israel sent some of those sniffing dogs over that used to sniff some bodies. And so they, you know, sent them over. But I don't recall anybody else sending anything over to us, you know, to help us. But anyway. And ex-official tells of Homeland Security failures. And let's see. Clark Kent Irvin. What kind of name is that? He said, well, Officer Irvin made some scathing findings. He reported that undercover investigators were able to sneak explosives and weapons. This is from a guy who worked in Homeland Security. And he said, undercover investigators were able to sneak explosives and weapons past security screeners at 15 airports during tests in 2003. Federal air marshals hired to provide as a last line of defense against terrorists slept on a job, test positive for alcohol or drugs while on duty, lost their weapons, and falsified information in 2002. I mean, get a little of this. And in department, they're the same ones who want the airports to privatize security again, so it makes, you know, really no sense at all. And the TSA spent nearly $500,000 on an awards banquet for employees in November 2003. The cost included $1,500 for three cheese displays and $3.75 for each soft drink. So I guess they couldn't go to Walmart and buy the Sam's Cola there for $2. But anyway, I think we're being joined by Josh from Oxblog. Josh,
hey,
there?
John, how you doing?
Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Can you hear me well?
Yep.
Okay, very good. Now, this is Josh. How do you say your last name? Chavetz?
Chavetz,
I'm sorry. And you're from Houston, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Now, actually, we brought you on to talk about your collection of Monty Python DVDs. Anyway.
It's a great collection.
There you go. I don't know. I don't really like Monty Python. Give me Benny Hill any day or Three Stooges, then you got me. But Monty Python, I don't know. But
I don't know. I think all the good humor since then owes a lot to them.
Yeah. And now, let me have a lot of listeners don't aren't quite familiar with the Ox blog. You know, give them a description of what the blog is.
Well, basically, it's a website where people can publish without knowing a whole lot about the technical end of it. Can publish basically anything they want to. I mean, there are a lot of personal blogs, a lot of blogs about very technical, minute topics. Oxblog happens to be about politics, international relations, current events, law, things like that. One of the wonderful things about blogs is that you're expected to sort of link to whatever you're talking about. So the idea is that you you really give more than a lot of other media outlets, you give your readers a chance to investigate things for themselves and to hear what you have to say about it, but also to make up their own minds.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's run by the three of you, right? Yourself?
That's right, Patrick, David, and myself.
Okay, now Patrick's in England, correct?
I'm sorry?
Patrick's in England, is that correct?
Yes, we all met in England. We were all students at Oxford. Patrick is the only one of us who's still over there.
Wow.
David lives in Virginia now, and I live in Connecticut, although, as you said, I'm in Houston visiting my parents for the holidays.
Very good. And you're also, David and yourself, you're both Rhodes Scholars. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, your blog's been in what, 2 years?
Going on three. Actually. We started in April 2002.
Okay. Now, I'm gonna backtrack. What's your comment about the tsunami? I'm sure you have something to, you know. What's your?
Well,
reaction?
I mean, first of all, obviously it's awful and it's truly tragic.
Horrible.
I think, obviously a large part of it is something there's not really much to say about, which is just that, sometimes truly awful things happen and there's not really a reason that we can point to. But I think there is definitely a political end to this, and that is that while obviously things like shifting the Earth's plates are things that no political decisions have any effect on.
Mm-hmm.
The damage it causes on the ground is something that the political decisions affect a lot. And obviously with an earthquake and with tsunamis of this size, there was going to be devastation no matter what. But I think a good analog actually might be the earthquake in Bam, Iran, that happened almost exactly a year before this one.
Yeah. That killed 30,000.
What interested me about that, I did a little bit of research into that, mm-hmm. and it, you know, Bam was a fairly small city. It was a city of 80,000 people. Mm-hmm. And there was an earthquake that was about 10 miles outside of the city, measuring about a 6.4 on the Richter scale. And what interested me is that that was actually a smaller earthquake than the 1994 Northridge earthquake in California, mm-hmm. which was about the same distance from Los Angeles, which is a city of about over 3.5 million people. Mm-hmm. And what interested me in that is that the death toll in Bam was about 40,000 people, and the death toll in Los Angeles was less than 60 people. Mm-hmm. And I think the sort of the takeaway lesson from that, and the lesson that I hope we can take away from disasters like this in general, is that the more politically and economically advanced the country gets, the more it can do to prepare for things like this. The better its building materials will be, the better its building codes will be, and the result of that is that fewer people will die. And so in the short term, we need to be doing a lot, and a lot more than we're doing, by the way, to help the people of South Asia recover. I think it's disgusting that we've only pledged $35 million in aid so far. I mean, that's what, a third of what Michael Vick just signed for with the Falcons.
Well, yeah.
But,
well, a lot of people are saying
that.
But
in the long term, what we can do is help these countries build better, help them grow richer as countries, and help them grow freer as countries, so that the next time this comes around, they have a better building code and a better way of surviving.
Well, a lot of people are saying that the Bush administration doesn't want to commit more money because it'll be given to the UN, which, you know, they've had problems with the UN before, and, you know, they're enmeshed in that oil for food scandal. But what do you think? You think we're just being stingy, or, you know, what's going on there? Think it's our problems with the UN that's holding us back, or what?
Well, there are a lot of ways to give that money that doesn't go through the UN.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the UN certainly has a lot of problems, and it is not high on my list of organizations to support. But, you know, we could, first of all, a lot of the countries that were sort of worst affected are governments that are countries with responsible democratic governments. We could go through the governments of those countries to try and bring support to try and give aid to the people.
Mm-hmm.
We could give support to non-governmental organizations. I know the American Red Cross is accepting donations. I know that a lot of the international relief organizations are. And the U.S. could bring support directly to the people. So it doesn't, you know, international aid doesn't always involve going through the UN.
Mm. Now, I mean, bring back the domestic issue here. Now, over in Ukraine. What do you think of the aftermath of the election in Ukraine with Yushchenko? Do you think that's over with, or it's going to keep dragging on?
Gosh, I hope it's over with. I think it probably will be. I mean, I think what's interesting is that after this most recent round, where we didn't see, even though obviously the outgoing prime minister's supporters are disheartened, what we didn't see was the protests in the street. You know, after the first round, Yushchenko's supporters really sort of, it seemed like they took a real lesson from the Velvet Revolution and from the, you know, fall of communism, and they poured out in the streets. They did it peacefully, but they made their feelings known.
Mm-hmm.
In sort of contrast to that, after the December 26th balloting, Yankovic's supporters stayed home. So since all the international observers seem to think that it was pretty much as free as could have been expected, I don't really see what would happen to overturn the most recent round.
Now, do you think Yushchenko is going to have a hard time governing with this tore apart country he's facing? I mean, half the country is, you know, basically Russia, you know, favoring Russia, and the other half is favoring him. It's like a split. You know, it's like red, left right here.
Yeah, I mean, he'll certainly have quite a few challenges to overcome. I think in general, as long as he governs with a measure of humility, and doesn't sort of go out of his way to antagonize the people who want closer ties with Moscow, I think he'll be fine. I think he understands this. I mean, he said before the election that if elected, his first foreign policy trip would be to Moscow. I think that's the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
I think he should, he needs to tell Putin that what's past is past, and let's see if we can forge a good relationship between Ukraine and Russia. But at the same time, of course, he needs to fulfill his campaign promises of bringing the Ukraine closer to the EU and closer to the West.
Mm-hmm.
And if he can you know, if he can approach both of those goals with moderation and with humility, I think that that he has a chance to pull off something fairly special in the Ukraine and something not unlike what we saw happen earlier in the year in Georgia.
Yeah, he seems like he's a charismatic leader. I mean, everybody in those streets, they just seem to just love him. They're all wearing orange. You know, pretty much you got to put a gun in my head to have me wear orange, but yeah, I don't know. But I mean,
he seems like he wants to do great things in the region.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, Ukraine. I keep wondering what is our interest in the Ukraine? I mean, I asked a couple weeks ago, is there oil there? Why are we even butting into that election? I mean, we got problems with our own election system here in the United States, and we are nosing into Ukraine's election. I mean, hell, they're still counting votes in Washington State, and they just got done certifying the votes in Ohio. I mean, even that's up in the air. I mean, we got to clean up our own mess here before we start butting in these other countries' election process. You know, what do you think?
Well, I think we definitely have an interest there.
Mm-hmm.
Our interest, first of all, is that we very much have an interest in trying to keep Russia on a path to westernization and modernization. And if we allow, if Russia again sort of surrounds itself with what might be called satellite states,
mm-hmm.
We have a real risk that Russia will backslide into a more imperialist mindset, which is obviously something that has some measure of appeal to Putin. So the more we can convince Putin that westernization and that democratization, liberalization really are sort of the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
That if he tries to become more authoritarian, that he's not going to have sort of supportive states around him, that he's going to have to deal with the EU and the West right on his doorstep. I think that sends a very powerful message to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the case that, Ukraine is strategically important in its own right. I mean, it was the breadbasket of the former Soviet Union. It's responsible for a lot of the food and the grain in the region. So a stable Ukraine is very important for the stability of that entire sort of region of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think some of the former Soviet nuclear weapons are still siloed in the Ukraine. So it's obviously important in that regard.
Yeah, true. Now, touch on Russia. Now, Russia, I think, for last year, a year and a half, 2 years, has been sliding backwards because they, they took over that one company and they auctioned off for a fraction of what it was worth. The Yukos company, is that the oil company? For what, $9 billion? They said it's worth, three, four, five times that amount of money, and they're persecuting that industrialist that's over there. And Putin's cracking down on free speech, and he's clamping down on the newspapers. I mean, are they sliding back? Do you believe, or what?
Russia. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely moved backwards. It's it's very worrisome, and it's not at all clear, at least to me, what is to be done about it. We clearly need to maintain diplomatic pressure, and I think a large part of that is, at least I think that's greatly facilitated by making it clear to Putin that that the sort of the days of Russian and Soviet Empire are over.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think I think events in the Ukraine, events in Georgia over the last year will prove to be very important in that. But we also need to make it clear through sort of every diplomatic channel possible that this is not acceptable.
Hmm. Now, looking at you're expert in politics and everything. What part of the world should we be paying attention to, which we're not right now? Is there something going on somewhere that the press isn't picking up on, or is something that's should be catching our attention, which it's not? Ireland, or something brewing anywhere?
I think Ireland's doing okay right now. I think there's obviously sort of the issue of sub-Saharan Africa, which has been sort of a mess for decades and hasn't gotten the attention it deserves, largely because it hasn't posed an immediate threat to anywhere in the West. I think we need to be more be less short-sighted about that. We need to realize that it's possible that if we do nothing about this region, it will come to pose a threat. You can't have a region where the economy is a disaster, where huge percentages of the population are dying from not just AIDS, which is, of course, a tragedy and a plague, but perfectly preventable diseases. I mean, things like malaria are still massive killers in huge parts of Africa, and there's no good reason for that. It would require very relatively small expenditures of public health dollars to really make a dent in the malaria in Africa, and we're not doing it. And I think it, I think that will sort of come back to, that will come back to hurt us, because what we've seen over and over is that what failed is, you know, terrorists are bred in failed states, and failed states are bred by things like economic stagnation, political corruption, and sort of a general sense of hopelessness. And there's nothing better calibrated to cause a sense of hopelessness than allowing these plagues to run rampant. I think the other region of the world we might want to be a little bit more concerned about is what's called the tri-border region in South America. And it's a region on the borders of Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina that is basically completely lawless. And it's sort of known as a breeding ground for international terrorism. It's almost like something out of a Bond movie.
Really?
You get representatives from the IRA, representatives from Hamas, representatives from Hezbollah, representatives from Al-Qaeda, all going down there, meeting with each other, training down there, because there's effectively no law in the region.
And if we don't start
looking a lot more carefully at that, greater and greater cooperation between terrorist groups that thus far we've been able to keep sort of apart from each other. I think we need to worry about that region of the world as well.
Right. Now, how come we're not doing anything about that? I mean, it seems like something we should be in there, you know, instead of reacting, we should be proactive and going in there and, you know, blowing them up or whatever we're going to do.
I would certainly agree that we need to be proactive there. I'm sure that we do have, sort of small-scale operations going on in the region.
Are we so distracted with Iraq that we're ignoring?
I think we don't have is sort of a major diplomatic push to get the governments of those countries to try and really get their border patrol in there, because there's only, we tend to think of our special operations forces as invincible, and while they are absolutely amazing and absolutely heroic, there's only so much the force of that size can do, and what we really need to be doing is getting cooperation from those governments, getting help from them, getting them to station divisions of their military and their border guard in that region.
Mm. Now, I'll move over a little more domestic politics. Now, how are you up on the DNC chair hunt? The Democratic
Commission? I'm sorry?
In the DNC? Who do you think is going to be running the DNC within next year? Hello?
I'm sorry, I keep losing you.
Who do you think is going to be running the Democratic National Committee next year? Hello? You there?
Hello?
Oh, hello. You there? Hold on. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now.
There you go. Now, I'm talking about the Democratic National Committee. Who's going to be running it next year?
Oh, the DNC. I don't know. I certainly think that if they have any sense, it won't be Dean. And I can't imagine that it will be Dean.
Think it'll be Donnie Fowler?
I think I think Dean has annoyed too many people too much and has shown himself sort of not to be, I mean, you really want sort of a team player running the DNC.
Mm-hmm.
I think if they're smart, they will come up with a name that sort of none of us have heard of before. Someone who is a pretty good money raiser, doesn't make a complete fool out of himself on TV the way McAuliffe does, and sort of can rally the different parts of the party behind him, if for no other reason than that they just don't know anything about him.
Who do you have in mind? I mean, who's out there that you can, you know? Somebody said Bill Clinton, but I don't think.
I mean, I don't have a great suggestion in mind. I think they could do worse than someone like Donna Brazile.
There you go.
She largely sat out this last election. She didn't back any of the candidates. She has proven herself a fairly adept political strategist. I don't think she's responsible for the disaster that was the Gore campaign in 2000. And I think that she's moderate, that she's reasonable, and that she sounds good on TV. And she would have a good chance of, as good a chance as anyone that I know of rallying the party behind her.
Hmm. What about former Michigan Governor Jim Blanchard? Supposedly he's kind of in there. He's a lobbyist right now, but he's kind of in the hunt.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he would be. I don't think he would be the worst pick.
Personally,
you know,
I see.
Go ahead. I think ultimately it is a job for the Washington Insider. You know, when Americans get polled and say they don't like Washington Insiders, they're talking about in their elected politicians. But running the running the DNC is sort of a consummate insider job, and that really should be what they're looking for, and that's to a large degree why they should not be looking at Howard Dean.
Okay. And now looking at you know the political events from this past year, I swore to the listeners I wasn't going to do these year in review things, but you know. Because they're hitting you over the head with all those things. CNN and all of them did it. And then, of course, the tsunami thing blew all that out of the water. But, I mean, looking back, what was the event of 2004? Was it the election? Was it the blogs? Was it, Howard Dean? You know, what do you think?
I think it was the election. I think the election will sort of be providing the political narrative for a long time to come. There were all sorts of sort of ridiculous political narratives that came out of it. There was this focus on the values voter as if it was some sort of, strange three-legged animal because one very badly worded, methodologically idiotic poll, asked people how important values were, and a lot of people said they were important. But I think we did see a lot of things coming out of this campaign. A lot of them were things I think that a lot of people who study political history would have predicted. From a historical standpoint, the selection of Kerry was just a very poor choice. I think it's very hard to take a career senator and make him appealing presidential material. I think people in general do want someone with executive experience. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be very hard in the foreseeable future to take a Democrat from the Northeast and make a viable political candidate out of him. I think the dominant theme of the election was national security, and I think what came out was that whatever their complaints with a lot of sort of specific Bush foreign policies, a lot of people trusted him on foreign policy in a way that they just didn't trust Kerry, and I think that's basically what it came down to.
So now you think, looking at 2005, 2006, Hillary's up for re-election. I really don't think she stands a chance of getting a nomination for president. Do you? I mean, no.
I don't think it's completely. I wouldn't say I don't think she stands a chance. I think there are a lot of people who really like her. As many people as there are who really hate her, I think there are a lot of people who think she's absolutely wonderful. And I also think that she will surprise a lot of people if she starts getting more media attention. I mean, the thing that's been really interesting for me to watch about her since she was elected to the Senate is just how moderate she's been and just how hardworking she's been. I think, on foreign policy, for example, she supported the war in Iraq. She voted for the Reconstruction Funds. I think she's been, she's put a lot of effort into sort of the less attention-grabbing issues. She's largely kept her head down, and I think when she starts getting more media attention, when she starts gearing up for a presidential run, if of course she does, I think those people who still have an open mind will be somewhat surprised by what they see. Mm-hmm. And the real question is how many people there still are with open minds, of course, but I don't know. I think political memories tend to fade fairly quickly, and I think she's got a shot.
Really, I can't see them because she's so polarizing, and she's in every one of those East Coast, he's a Massachusetts liberal, she'll be a New Yorker liberal. I still think they have to go for governor.
Well, of course, she's a New Yorker who grew up in Chicago and spent a good part of her life in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. I think she'll certainly be reminding people of that when she hits the campaign trail.
Yeah. Well, she would have been smarter if she ran for senator from Arkansas, and that would have put her in the red states. That way she would stand a better chance of getting some southern votes.
No, that's true.
But
I think she's got, part of it depends on, you know, Bill Clinton has shown that he has sort of very, very, very short political coattails. Mm-hmm. You know, he couldn't manage to pull Congress with him from 94 on. Yeah. Almost everyone he campaigned for in 2000 lost. Almost everyone he campaigned for in 2004 lost. So a lot depends on whether some of the sort of Bill Clinton charm can rub off on Hillary Clinton, and whether he can help her carry one or two of those red states.
Hmm. And now, what do you think John Kerry's going to do? Do you think he's going to run again in 08 or what?
No, I don't think.
No,
I
think he's finished.
I mean, even if he thinks he's going to, I don't think he'll be given that option.
No.
The political parties in general don't like losers, and he lost, and he lost badly. I mean, no one. It's not like Gore, where people could say, you know, well, maybe he actually won, and he certainly won popular vote with Kerry.
He lost.
And frankly, to lose in 2004, I mean, took some doing. Bush was pretty unpopular. A good candidate could have beaten him, and I don't think anyone wants to see Kerry back.
Josh, you have a question from Rolando in the studio?
Josh, how you doing? I'm Rolando, the one that called you. How about Gore running in 2008 and pulling a Nixon and taking off 4 years and then running again after a close loss?
I would be shocked. I mean, at this point, I think most people's response would be Gore who? He made a pretty obvious play this year to be sort of the one of the champions of the Dean wing. You know, he came out and, you know, he came out and endorsed Dean right before Dean's implosion.
It was a kiss of death.
I think that was sort of his last play for political relevance.
Mm-hmm.
I think he thought that if he could be seen as the leader, as sort of the second in command of that wing of the party, then, you know, maybe if Dean got the nomination but lost, it would be Gore's turn again in 2008. Well, that obviously didn't turn out so well, and I can't imagine anyone turning to Al Gore as their idea of the political savior.
No. I don't think so.
So maybe
either.
He could pull like,
so.
Like Nixon.
No, Nixon. You got to move on, Rolando. The Democrats are going to live in the past. We got to move forward. You know?
Yeah, I think. I mean, this is saying something, but I don't think I don't think Gore has Nixon's charisma.
You're kidding me.
And I also think we're living in a very different political climate.
How about Bill Bradley? The chat room saying, "How about Bill Bradley?" No, he's been out of the public spotlight way too long, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think again, you can't be out of things that long at this point, and expect people to remember who you are and to be willing to take a chance on you like that.
Yeah, he's been invisible since, you know, the last go around when he got clobbered by Gore. You know.
Yeah.
I think if the Democrats are smart, I look at the governor from Virginia, Mark Warner. I mean, he's like a Clinton light. You know, he's got the money in the bank. He's got the attractive wife. He's got the kids. He's doing some reform work in Virginia with the tax code and everything. I mean, that'd be a smart choice. A governor. You need a governor.
Yeah, I think Warner would be a good choice. I think Bredesen from Tennessee wouldn't be a bad choice.
Who?
Phil Bredesen. Bredesen.
Bredesen. That's too long of a name. You know. I'm serious. You can't, like, Rudy, we won't have a president named Rudy, you know, because he looks like an accountant with a comb over. It won't be Pataki. He looks like the Principal Belding from Saved by the Bell. I mean, all these guys. You got to be somebody, you have to look presidential to be president. I'm sorry. It's the way it is now, right?
Well, I think,
I mean, Dean's got that weird way he moves his lips, too. It kind of looks like Cliff Cargo.
Right.
You know?
I mean, you can't look completely ridiculous. On the other hand, if we just voted on who looks more presidential, it would have been Kerry in a landslide, right?
Yeah.
I think superficial things like that matter, but maybe not as much as is fashionable to suggest.
I don't know. I just think he's the logical choice. I mean, a lot of them are saying that you know, they want to amend the Constitution for Schwarzenegger so he could run in 08. What do we think about that?
I think that's absolutely a good idea.
You serious?
Not because, I mean, I think Schwarzenegger has been a good governor, but this I think putting Schwarzenegger aside completely, I think I don't think there's any good reason for us to be discriminating against the foreign-born anymore in our choice of presidents.
Wow.
you know, especially you look at, I mean, and now is actually a very opportune time for it because the governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, was born in Canada. And she is incredibly smart, incredibly telegenic, and has been a very good governor. So it's in both parties' interest right now to try and get this amendment through. And I think it would be good for the country, not just because it would give us sort of more people of talent from whom we could choose, but also because of the message it would send to the world. The message that, right now the message we're sending is, you know, you can be born anywhere in the world, you can come to our shores, and you too can grow up to be governor.
Yeah.
Well, I think we can do better than that. You know, we can say, you can come to our shores, and you too can grow up to be president. And if that means that we get, you know, we have more presidential candidates like Granholm and, yes, like Schwarzenegger, I think that's all the more reason to do it.
I don't know if you had a chance, I don't know if you watch Late Edition on Sundays with Wolf Blitzer, but he had David Dreyer, you know, congressman from California on there, and he's saying that they're trying to, he's trying to get an amendment that will allow the president, whoever the president is, to run for a third term. What do you think about that?
That, I think, is a bad idea. I think that, you know, of the many sort of truly noble things that George Washington did, possibly the greatest was, one of the two greatest. One of them was certainly handing over control of the Continental Army after winning the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. And the second was handing over the presidency after the end of his second term. It was clear to everyone that he would have easily been reelected, but he decided to set a precedent that, that as a statesman, he would not seek life appointment. He would not seek to rule until his death. He would not just go on and on in office. Mm-hmm. I think that was a truly noble and a truly wonderful precedent to set. It was followed by every president until Roosevelt. And when Roosevelt broke that precedent, people felt strongly enough about it to amend the Constitution to say that presidents could not serve more than two terms. I think it would be foolish and frankly an insult to Washington's memory to start monkeying with that now, and I see no particularly good reason to do it. It's not clear to me that we're being deprived of the services of some great statesman simply because of the two-term limit.
Yeah. Now in the chat room, Dino Don, is saying two terms for president is just fine. We need to limit the House and the Senate. Do you think we need term limits on the congressmen and the senators?
That's a little bit of a tougher question because one of the nice things about the president sort of has to be responsible first and foremost. Has to be responsible for everything. He is the entirety of the executive branch of government is vested in one man, the president. Congress, on the other hand, is a committee of over 500 people, and one of the nice things about that is it allows people to build up different areas of expertise. And there really are some people in Congress who are amazingly knowledgeable about, in some cases, very arcane topics. Richard Lugar, the Republican from Indiana, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, knows more than anyone else about nuclear nonproliferation. He's incredibly good at it. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of expertise that it would be sort of a shame to lose. So I'm not saying there aren't very good reasons for term limits to Congress. But there are also, I think, fairly good reasons to think twice about it.
Now, again, a question from the somebody I am'd me. Who are your political inspirations? Who do you read up on, or you know?
That's a good question.
Kennedy.
I mean, I think most of my political, I'm sort of a historian at heart, so most of my political inspirations are long dead. But I think, at least certainly as far as American political inspirations go, I think that certainly George Washington is one of them. A sort of a little-known founder named James Wilson, who after Madison was probably the person most responsible for drafting the Constitution, is one of them. Wilson believed probably more strongly than anyone else at the founding in the idea of popular sovereignty and wrote and spoke some of the most eloquent words in its defense and was an early justice of the Supreme Court and wrote some fantastic opinions from the bench. He's certainly one of them. Abraham Lincoln is certainly one of them. I think that's probably my pantheon. And I think we could all sort of, especially a lot of our politicians, could do well to go back and read a lot of their words and their wisdom.
Now, who currently do you go back? Do you make a point of watching? Like every time I see Kissinger on, I try to make a point of watching him, or Dr. Brzezinski from the Carter, you know, Secretary of State under President Carter. There's somebody on that you make a point of watching when they're on TV or on the radio.
Well, one of my actually both of my senators. I think both Joe Lieberman and Chris Dodd are among the finest people in public office today. I think, probably no surprise, but I think John McCain is as well. Mm. And I think they often, especially when they're talking about foreign policy, just have very good things to say.
Mm. I mean, like Clinton or Carter?
Carter I'm not so fond of. I think he's... I think he's too trusting of despots. I think he's not sufficiently interested in political freedoms that he's willing to work with people who are best not worked with. And I think that's come back to hurt us in a number of cases.
Hmm. Anybody else come to mind? How about Rush Limbaugh?
Okay.
How about Rush? Rush Limbaugh?
Definitely not a fan of Rush Limbaugh. I think that one of the most important political values in any democratic society is civility in political discourse. I think it's absolutely crucial that people who disagree with each other talk to each other, and that they talk not scream at each other, but actually talk to each other, try and convince each other, try and reason with each other, and yes, at the end of the day, leave the table as friends, even if they haven't convinced each other of a single thing. I don't agree with most of my friends about most political issues, but they're still, you know, my closest friends, and they're still the people I admire and trust most in the world. And I think that it's people like Rush Limbaugh and people like Ann Coulter and people like Michael Moore, people like Thomas Frank, who really do more than anyone else to hurt political discourse in America, not because of any particular positions they take, but because of the way they take those positions. The title of Ann Coulter's new book, How to Talk to a Liberal If You Must,
there you go. Yeah.
I think perfectly sums up everything that's wrong with her.
Yeah. Well,
the idea that she wouldn't even want to talk to people who disagree with her is just disgusting. And and certainly no one who has that attitude, and I think Limbaugh very much has that attitude, would be counted among my political heroes.
Well, Ann Coulter almost got a pie in the face a couple months ago from those guys that rushed the stage at some speech she was giving. I don't know if you saw that, but she almost got nailed.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, and now looking at, you know, President Bush's agenda for next year, where do you think he's going? Think he's gonna get the privatization of Social Security, or where do you think he's gonna choose his fight?
I think the sort of two fights that he really wants to pick on the domestic agenda are making the tax cuts permanent and privatizing Social Security. He will probably get part of the way there on both of them. I mean, one of the things that he was very good at during his first term, especially on domestic issues, was getting a little bit more than anyone thought he could out of Congress. And I would be surprised, especially if the economy keeps looking up, I'd be really surprised if he doesn't get at least a substantial portion of the tax cuts made permanent. And depending on how well he sells it, I would be surprised if he doesn't at least go a fairly long way towards Social Security privatization. I think there's still an awful lot of policy work to be done on that. Forget the politicking. Before we even get to the politicking, he needs to explain how we're going to pay for it, how we're going to pay for the benefits that are due to people who've already put an awful lot of money into the existing system. He needs to make the case for why this isn't going to have a hugely distorting effect on the markets.
True.
I am hopeful that some member of the administration will make this case before they start sort of making the push in earnest to pass this into law.
Okay. Now, we only got a couple minutes left. I was now looking ahead for yourself. What do you hope to be doing? I mean, what are you doing now? I mean,
well, right now I just finished up my doctorate in political science at Oxford, and I'm currently a law student at Yale.
Congratulations!
And when that's all over, I hope eventually to be a law professor.
Wow, very good. You're not going to go into politics to be a?
No, I don't. I don't think I'm cut out for it.
Really? No, you seem like you're interested in the affairs of the country and everything. So sounds like it's made out perfectly well.
Well, I enjoy thinking and talking about the issues. I'm not sure that I would actually enjoy sort of the rough and tumble of how they're practiced.
Now, looking forward to 2005 with President Bush. I mean, now they say that this the second term is full of scandals. What's coming? You think it might cause him some trouble? Is it going to be the abuse of prisoners? What might cause Bush some problems in the new term?
Well, I mean the prisoner abuse. Hopefully, I mean I would have hoped it would have caused him more problems before now. I mean, it's really sort of the most disgraceful story to come out in the last year, and it's unfortunate that it doesn't seem to be gaining any traction because this is bad. I mean, this is just flat out morally reprehensible. It's also terrible in the eyes of the world. I mean, it's not getting much attention here, but it's getting a lot of play in European media, and it's getting a lot more play in Arab media, and it's making us look really bad, and we need to make sure that that does not happen again. I don't know what the new scandals will be. I do hope that sort of an accumulation of the existing scandals will be enough to drive Secretary Rumsfeld out of office. I think he's done some good work, but I think he's done a lot of bad work, and most disturbingly, I think he's not willing or able to admit the mistakes he's made. And if you can't admit where you screwed up, it makes it a lot harder to fix it. And I think that that he needs to go.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised he hasn't gone by now. I mean, really, a lot of these problems root back to his advice, and there's not enough troops over there. I mean, something has to be done. I would have preferred to have him Powell as the Secretary of Defense than Rumsfeld, because he believes in an overwhelming force.
Yeah, I think. I'm not sure I would say that. I would have perhaps preferred some combination of Rumsfeld and Powell. I think on some of the sort of biggest policy issues, Rumsfeld was right and Powell was wrong. I mean, I think that the war in Iraq was the right thing to do. I think it was carried out very poorly, and I think Rumsfeld deserves almost all of the blame for that. But of course, if it had been up to Powell, I don't think we would have gone to war in Iraq at all, and I think that would have been a mistake, just like it was a mistake the first Gulf War not to march on Baghdad, and again, that was done on Colin Powell's advice. So while I very much admire Powell and admire his service to his country, I don't think that the Powell Doctrine would have been healthy for the country over the past 4 years.
Now, Josh, we only have like about a minute left. Anything you want to say to anybody out there? I mean, you got a minute. It's yours.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all of your listeners.
Thank you.
I guess if there's one thing I could sort of hope for politically in the new year, it would again just go back to the point about civility, and that especially now that the rancor of the election is behind us, that we can talk to each other as friends and as Americans again, and not as sort of rabid Democrats or Republicans.
That's true. That's right. Like I said, we're all in this together. I mean, take a look what's happening over there in Asia. I mean, it should tell you how the fragility of life and how we got to appreciate every moment we have, because we don't know when it could be our last. Correct?
Absolutely.
I mean, if we can wipe out, between upwards of almost 100,000 people, and it should tell you. I mean, we're at the mercy of Mother Nature. So, But other than that, Josh, I thank you very much for joining us.
And, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's Josh from Oxblog joining us on the show. And next week we'll have Joe Fish from USN DemVet. He's coming on to the show. And a couple weeks ago he was supposed to come on. He couldn't due to he was busy. And so anyway, he's coming on next week. And anyway, thank you for listening. Oxblog, www.oxblog.com is for Oxblog. And thank you all, and have a good night, and Happy New Year.
From Vegas.
get my hand and come with me, because you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. I say you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. 4, 5, 6, come on and get your kicks. Now you don't need the money when you look like that, do you, honey? Big black boots, long brown hair, she's so sweet with her get back stare. Well, I can see you are with me, but you are with another thing, yeah. I know we ain't got much to say before I let you get away, yeah. I said, are you gonna be my girl?